This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich, where you, me and the top experts gather together in a room for 28 minutes to understand one of the big issues of the day. Today, the GameStop revolution. Hedge funds and retail investors. What's going on and why does it matter? Until last week, GameStop was a chain of shops in the US selling video game consoles and consumer electronics. Representing old technology, its shares knocked along at about $7 each. Last week, at its peak, that became nearly $500. GameStop became an online cause célèbre, and people started talking about a stock market revolution. What happened? And how has it changed our world? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we need some very recent history. Elizabeth Lopato is the deputy editor of a tech news website in California called The Verge. We asked her to explain what's been going on.
This has been completely a wild ride. It's a brand new trick that the internet has learned. And as far as I can tell, there doesn't seem to be any underlying immunity to it in the financial markets. So this wild ride may not be the only wild ride that we go on. I think the moment it came to everybody's attention was on January 22nd, when there was a trading halt on GameStop because it had gone up 69%. And at that point, I think most of the rest of us noticed something weird was happening. GameStop has been a relatively reliable place for hedge funds to make money on short selling. And short selling works like this. Let's say you have a brand new mobile phone, but you're not going to use it for a month for some reason. So I ask to borrow your phone. And then I turn around and immediately sell it. In the meantime, before you get back, the price on that exact same phone drops. And so I go out and buy you a brand new phone. And then when you return, I give it to you. That's short selling. The profit in there that I make from the difference between what I sold your phone for and what I bought the new phone for is mine. Now, this is dangerous business because when shorting is not successful, it's more like this. I sell your iPhone and I have to give it back to you, right? Like, we've agreed to that. So the price of the iPhone goes up for whatever reason, but because I still have to give you your iPhone back, I have to go and buy it at the more expensive price. And that's how you lose money shorting.
Before Elizabeth goes on, there are a couple of things you need to know. The first is that Our Wall Street Bets is an online community on the Reddit platform where people discuss investment strategies. The second is about Robinhood, the app through which you can buy and sell shares. Okay? Now onward with Elizabeth.
Reddit is essentially a series of online forums with different interests. There's a running Reddit, there's a knitting Reddit, like any hobby you can think of, there's a Reddit for it. Our Wall Street Bets is pretty much what it sounds like. Part of the culture of the place is taking really risky gambles and then posting your wins or losses. What happened is, like, people started posting about GameStop, and they started posting that they were buying shares. It was all very open, in contrast to most of the rest of the financial system, which is intentionally opaque because they're basically playing poker. We started to see more and more of this, and it seems like it began to gather momentum, and it seems like it became this sort of self-reinforcing feedback loop. There was certainly a story about the Redditors taking on the hedge funds, and this was a thing for the little guy, and that was how you were going to take down the big jerks who had hedge funds and all of the fat cats on Wall Street. And one of the reasons I don't totally buy this story is that the methods that they were using to try to take on these hedge funds are relatively sophisticated and suggest that the people who were involved in the initial strategy making understand the markets really well, which means that they're probably also people who understand financial risk in a way that ordinary people don't. I would be very careful with ascribing motivations to people who are posting anonymously online. It's totally possible that there are people who do genuinely believe they were taking on the hedge funds, but it's also possible that some people were just shitposting, which is internet slang for when you put something online that's not particularly serious or worthwhile. So I think some of those posts are relatively tongue-in-cheek, but it's impossible to know how seriously the people who read them are taking them. For people who are relatively well off and have been working from home and haven't gone anywhere, they've been saving a lot of money over the course of this coronavirus crisis. A lot of people opened day trading accounts last year. I have to say, I think a fair amount of it is pandemic boredom. You know, you get your entertainment wherever you can. And right now it looks like the stock market is a site of entertainment for a lot of people. Robinhood is a retail trading platform, and there are any of a number of these kinds of brokerages that you can trade with. But Robinhood is particularly notable because it targeted retail investors, and it's something that you can get on your phone. It sends you notifications, and it also, crucially, provides free trading, which is now the norm across many brokerages, but was not at the time. So it created this kind of frictionless environment for all of these newly minted day traders to begin doing more sophisticated financial stuff than they had been able to before. Then what happened was that Robinhood put restrictions on buying and selling GameStop and a couple of other stocks that were favorites of our Wall Street bets. They weren't the only brokerage that did this. The reason the brokerages did this has to do with the financial plumbing, basically the system that's underneath where you trade. So there are these places called clearinghouses where brokerages keep their money. And there's a certain amount of money you have to keep in order to make sure that people are confident trading. So it's basically just like collateral almost for the trade. The amount of money you have to keep there varies. The more risky a trade becomes, the more money you have to put in the clearinghouse. And basically what happened last week is that Robinhood, I think, did not have enough money to put in the clearinghouse to allow people to go on trading the way that they had been before. And in fact, they had to go out and raise, I think it was $2 billion in order to basically meet their requirements. They explained this very poorly because most people just woke up and discovered that they couldn't buy shares in GameStop and a couple of other stocks anymore. People were furious, saying that, Robinhood was colluding with the hedge funds in order to rob the little guys. And this sort of conspiracy theory took off that the retail investors had been too successful and they were threatening Wall Street, and Wall Street had called Robinhood to shut it down. Now, I don't believe that is true. And I don't believe it for a wide variety of reasons. But the most obvious one is that if you look at the volume of trades, it can't just be the retail investors in there. There's probably some high frequency trading and maybe some other hedge funds. So it seems like what happened is the simplest explanation, that Robinhood didn't have enough money to meet its clearinghouse requirements. And meanwhile, the stock continued going up because Wall Street got in on whatever was happening and has been merrily trading itself as well. There's been a certain amount of political reaction here in the U.S., and to be clear, it's been both Democrats and Republicans, but one of the people who is most notably involved is Elizabeth Warren. Part of what Elizabeth Warren has said about it is something that reflects the broader nature of what's been going on in the stock market versus what's been happening for most people in the U.S. The stocks have been doing great, and a lot of people are unemployed. We have a lot of people who are going hungry, so there seems like there's almost two economies happening. I think that's part of what's fueling some of the normal guy versus Wall Street resentment behind parts of the GameStop trade. But I also think that it's part of what's fueling some of the distrust of the financial services and Robinhood halting trading, because the people who are upset about this feel they're being taken advantage of yet again by the rich hedge funds.
Elizabeth Lopato ending there by reflecting on the dissatisfaction that both gave rise to the GameStop affair and was occasioned by it. As she mentioned, one of the voices raised to argue something should be done is Democrat Senator Elizabeth Warren, here speaking to CNN.
What's happening with GameStop is just a reminder of what's been going on Wall Street now for years and years and years. It's a rigged game. And it's been a set of players who come in and manipulate the market. They've turned this stock market not into a place where you get capital formation to support businesses, but more into a casino.
Elizabeth Warren. We'll come back to her suggestions for action later. So now we know about GameStop and about shorting. Next, I want to understand hedge funds. What do they do? And is there a good reason for them? Joining me now in the briefing room is Sebastian Malaby. His book on hedge funds is called More Money Than God. Sebastian Malaby, can you explain to us what a hedge fund actually is and how it differs from the other financial investment organisations like fund managers and so on?
A hedge fund is a kind of fund manager, and it's distinguished by a few things. One is that the way it gets paid is a bit different. A normal unit trust sort of mutual fund manager typically takes, let's say, 1% of all the money they collect. And they take that every year, 1% a year, 1% a year. It doesn't matter if the fund goes up or down. They just get 1% of the assets under management. A hedge fund gets most of its pay from performance. So take 20% of the upside of what they earn. And that gives them a big incentive to really do the research to find out how to do clever investments. They get a management fee as well, but the bulk of their pay comes from this performance fee. And the other thing to note is that they usually have their own personal savings in the fund. So if they blow up because they're stupid, it actually costs them in their wallet.
Now, one of the things that's interesting culturally about hedge funds is that they're often portrayed as almost villainous, really, and people cheer when they lose money. Is this rational?
No. If you have four quantitative people in California setting up a small company, it's usually a tech startup. And basically, people like tech startups. They think that's great. It builds cool stuff. If you have four quantitative people setting up a small company in Connecticut or New York, it's probably a hedge fund and people hate it. I don't think that's rational.
But what people would say is, there's a function to the tech company. It gives us things we like. And what they will always, almost always say about the hedge fund is there's no real function to it and we don't see any benefit from it. So I'm imagining that you are going to tell me that there are actually benefits to it that they don't understand.
Yes, they're elusive, difficult to see, but they do really, really exist. And I'll explain why. Basically, the world is uncertain. We can agree on that. Currencies will go up and down. Some companies will do well. Some companies will do badly. Interest rates will go up, down, sideways, whatever. The future is difficult to predict. So there's risk. So somebody is going to put money down to finance companies or to finance the building of houses or to finance lots of different projects. And you don't know in advance what the return will be. So when you allocate savings to productive uses, there is going to be risk. And ultimately, we have to decide as a society, where do we put the risk? We have a choice. We can put the risk in big financial institutions, which tend to be bailed out by taxpayers, that's you and me, when they go wrong. That's what we saw in the 2008 financial crisis. Or we can put this risk in small enough to fail hedge funds, which are not systemically dangerous. That means they can go bust. And the only people who care are the investors who put their money in. So I do think that hedge funds perform a function in housing risk that would be worse for society if it was put somewhere else.
So where does something like short selling fit into that? Because to a lot of people, they look at that and think, this doesn't have anything to do necessarily with the actual productive value of a company or its future. This looks a bit more like what Elizabeth Warren has famously called a casino.
There's no intrinsic reason why betting that something will go down is more casino-like than betting that it will go up. If I go off and do some very careful research on a particular company and I discover that it's actually got much better prospects in the future than everybody else thinks, I can bet that it will go up, and that's a research-based, non-casino kind of activity. Or I could go look at the same company and discover that they're hiding a fraud, and when the fraud comes out, the stock price will collapse, and I can bet that it will go down. They're both research-based. Neither have anything to do with casino. This casino, of course, in the stock markets, lots of people on Reddit are making bets, which I don't think are very much based on much research. So there's definitely a casino element in financial markets, but it's not that shorting is more casino-like than betting on things going up.
Sebastian, you said that in some situations, hedge funds have had a role even in exposing frauds within companies. Are there any major examples that you can give us?
The most famous recent example is the German company Wirecard, which was up to all sorts of accounting tricks, which was a very prominent company in Germany and therefore had a lot of politicians and indeed regulators kind of protecting it. And that fraud was exposed by a combination of investigative journalism by the Financial Times, but also by short sellers who started to sell the shares, pushing the price down, until those price signals finally forced Wirecard to confess to the fraud and the company was suitably punished.
OK, now we've had the GameStop furore, and incredibly interesting it's been too. Do you think that it's likely that hedge funds overall have made money during this affair?
Yes, we're just starting to see stories coming out about particular hedge funds that made a lot of money betting on GameStop very early. There's one which made $700 million. So yes, I do think that hedge funds will end up, when all the dust settles, having come out ahead.
And that presumably means that some of the others, smaller investors who've got involved, will come out behind.
I do think that's right. I mean, you know, it's going to be a mixed picture, though obviously there's been well-publicised instances of hedge funds that have lost money on this. So it's not a, you know, you have people on both sides of the trade, which is why, by the way, casting this whole thing as a morality tale of small investors against rich hedge funds is never quite true, right? Because the hedge funds are actually on both sides of it. But I think on balance, what we tend to see is that the people who know more about finance tend to do better when they trade in financial markets. And the hedge funds who, you know, paid to do this, and that's what they do all day long, tend to beat the amateurs.
Sebastian Mallaby, let's widen this discussion and also throw it forward. Does the GameStop affair suggest a growing disconnect between stock markets and the real economy, in which, as we know, businesses are closing and people are losing their jobs? And is what happened over GameStop a harbinger of a necessary revolution or of financial anarchy? Joining me now in the briefing room are Susanna Streeter, who's a senior market analyst at the financial services company Hargreaves Lansdown, and Philip Coggan of The Economist. Philip Coggan, this entire business has been cast as David versus Goliath. Do you think that is broadly right or just wildly simplistic?
I think it's wildly simplistic. So to take one example, this has been portrayed against the retail investor versus a hedge fund. But one hedge fund, the Wall Street Journal, reported that Senvest Management, it's made $700 million out of the GameStop rise because it owned 5% of the company before the retail investors piled in. And the other thing to think about is that, let's say, most of the people who piled in were retail investors. We don't know that. It may be that other hedge fund managers were buying as well. But they forced the price up to $480 at the peak. It's now down below $100 as we tape this. So that means if it's a David versus Goliath battle, David, in this case, who bought at the top, has turned the slingshot and fired it at his own face.
Susanna, is that how you see it too?
Yes, definitely. What's happened here is that although the firing gun may have been fired by the Reddit army, the wave of speculation has caught so many other retail investors up. And that is the real danger here, in the fact that they are believing the hype, getting sucked up in this. And the really important message to get across is that this is speculation. It isn't investment. Investment is looking at the longer term by jumping onto the coattails of a stock that appears to be rising, that is very dangerous. The overall stock market, on average, gains around 8% a year. If you've got a rise of 1,000% in a matter of days, something isn't adding up. And I think there's been a really hard reality that many smaller investors have had to face up to.
But they've obviously had a lot of fun doing it. I mean, that's the impression that one gets. So I'm bound to ask you both whether or not this couldn't just very easily happen again and isn't waiting to happen again next week, Philip.
Yes, I'm sure it will happen again, and it's happened in the past. In the 1920s, there were occasions when share prices were forced up very fast on the back of retail investors as well as institutions. In the late 1990s, the internet bubble, we saw lots of this happen. There was one example of a company called Oxygen, which was backed by Elizabeth Murdoch. It just raised cash to invest in other internet companies. It raised the equivalent of tuppence a share. And at the end of the first day's trading, it was at 65p a share as retail investors piled in. And of course, after that, the share price collapsed again. So these things happen, you know, every so often. And it's usually when the returns on other investments like cash aren't very good and the market's been going up for a while and people get caught up in it. I would think that now people have seen that they can force share prices up by having a chat about it on the internet, they'll do it again.
Is that what you expect, Susanna?
Absolutely, of course. As Philip was saying, we've seen the dot-com bubbles bubbling up and then popping. What's different now is that social media is so much more advanced and the cat really is out of the bag as far as social media is concerned and won't be put back in again. I do think that we're going to see more bubbles in retail activity. Look, we saw it and we keep seeing it with Bitcoin, for example, and I don't think this is going to wane.
Now, let's talk about regulation, because you, Susanna, suggested that there are some very real dangers in this approach, in that speculation becomes entirely unmoored from value. And Elizabeth Warren has been talking about regulation that could conceivably be brought in. What do you make of that?
I can completely understand why she would like to see regulation brought in. And we've also seen the new Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, trying to convene a high-level meeting to look at what happened and try and damp down on this volatility. But it's going to be extremely difficult to try and regulate what's happening on social media. Look at the problems, for example, faced by Facebook. And no matter how many moderators you put on these sites to remove comment or trying to adjudicate about what's been happening, the comment will just pop up somewhere else. It's also going to be very difficult to prove that certain individuals were really out to game the system and have intent to cause market manipulation, even though many people say, well, look, you can just read on the message boards. But actually clamping down on that is going to be very difficult.
OK, so Philip, do you think that regulation is A, likely, and B, would be effective?
I think we're already seeing the effect of existing regulation. Robinhood had to pause trading in some of these stocks for a while because the regulators know that when you do all this trading, there's a risk that people won't pay up, and Robinhood has to put up more capital to back the trades that it was undertaking. And those regulations were introduced, some of them, after the last financial crisis to try and prevent the kind of systemic risk that we saw, you know, with all the problems with US properties. So I think the main purpose of this will be that regulators will be looking to say, what's the risk that when one of these bubbles pops, you know, people won't be able to pay for their shares, financial firms will go bust, and this will have the same sort of problem we saw 10 years ago. And that's where I think they'll concentrate rather than trying to shut down the chat rooms.
Do you think, Susanna, that a lot of this feeling about regulation emerges from a perception that not just these new retail investors, but particularly hedge funds in the past, have made an awful lot of money, which they haven't really deserved, out of dealing in companies without concern about what happens in the real world?
I do think what's happened, yes, is that it's been fueled by a feeling that the financial markets are really disconnected with what is happening in the real world. We've seen the NASDAQ, for example, in 2020, the S&P 500, huge gains in 2020 at the same time that COVID was really causing so much damage to the wider US economy. But it's because a large proportion of the S&P 500, for example, is weighed heavily towards the tech sector. And the tech sector has performed very strongly during the pandemic. And so it's kind of skewed, in a way, the index. And what's happening is people are saying, look, why is Wall Street making so much money when I'm not getting any money in my pocket? In fact, I'm losing my job. And it's just unfair. And I think this is fueling it. When it comes to retail investors as well, even those retail investors who do have more money in their pocket and they can invest in the stock market, they feel that they're being shut out from some of the larger gains that institutional investors can benefit from. And I don't think that's going to change until the way that they're treated changes.
The sense that I'm getting from both of you is the growing gap between perception and reality, the way in which people think the world is going and the way in which the financial world seems to play out. And Susanna, you've noted here the rise of social media as, if you like, a kind of wild card in this. I'm bound to ask, given that's the case, aren't we likely to see other phenomena which have been associated with these kind of things, like Russian hackers getting into Wall Street?
I think Russian hackers are trying to get into Wall Street all the time. And I think that is why the financial sector has got to be so robust. And not just Russian hackers. I mean, cybersecurity is such a big issue for financial services in general. And as I don't think that's necessarily that new a phenomenon. It's a growing one. What I think we are seeing, though, is, like we've seen across the media, with the social media comes kind of viral information that passes like lightning through chat groups. And like it swayed elections in the past, we are now seeing it sway financial markets as well. And so it's up to the mainstream financial sector, like the mainstream media, to renew their efforts to try and communicate good practice, diversification, investing for the long term, as opposed to getting swept up by the hype and believing in the hype, like we've seen across the media as well. It's similar challenges, I believe, are unfolding.
Philip, if that's the case, then one could feel pessimistic. Speaking as somebody in the mainstream media, I feel it's been incredibly difficult to counter this kind of stuff in social media. And if the same pertains in the financial world, that could be really troubling.
Yes, and indeed, this has always been the case. If you go back all the way to the Dutch market of the 17th century, people used to drop letters with false stories about companies on the stock market in the hope that other traders would pick them up and draw the wrong conclusions and sell when they wanted to buy. Now, this is, well, as long as there's money to be made, there'll be people trying to game it. Already, hedge funds are employing language processing tools to try and analyse these Reddit groups and other groups and try and buy the shares where people are optimistic and sell the shares where they're pessimistic. So, you know, in this game, the people with the big amounts of money are always going to win. It's like going to a casino. The house wins at the end. If you speculate a lot, the best way to get $1 million is go onto the stock market, trade a lot when you start with $2 million. It's just not a winning game. The only winning game is buy as cheaply as possible and hold. And this is, entire example is the wrong one for most retail investors.
Philip Coggan and Susanna Streeter. And my conclusion, mind out for your investments, because there's more of this to come. My thanks to Elizabeth Lopato, Susanna Streeter, Sebastian Malaby and Philip Coggan. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's our recent episode on what the attack on the Capitol in Washington means for American democracy. There's the one that asks why Vladimir Putin is so afraid of Alexei Navalny. And also one on whether there might be a referendum on the reunification of Ireland anytime soon.
Hello, did you know that in a million years there'll be no more total solar eclipses because the moon is gradually moving away from the Earth? Or that during China's Cultural Revolution, people were arrested for bourgeois habits like keeping a pet or wearing tight trousers? I'm Melvin Bragg, and those are two of the extraordinary things I've learned while presenting the latest series of In Our Time. Each week, I ask three expert academic guests to break down and illuminate everything from quantum gravity to the nature of humanity, from Confucius to Augustus, from Beowulf to Boudicca. So if you're curious about the world around you, or you simply want to win your next general knowledge quiz, subscribe to In Our Time on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.